You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the opinions of KUCI or the Regents of the University of California. Welcome to In the Garden with University of California Master Gardeners. I'm Tina Spindler, a UC Master Gardener and the host of today's program. And I'm really excited because I have one of my best Master Gardener friends in the studio today with me, Kay Havens. Kay, welcome.
It's so great to talk to you, Tina. I think we've had some of our best garden adventures together, and I always look forward to talking to you, especially on some of our favorite subjects.
Yes, and we can hardly contain ourselves because whenever the seasons are changing and we know we get to plant new gardens, we can just barely, it's like kids on Christmas morning, we can barely contain ourselves.
You know, the seed catalogs have been coming through the winter, and we haven't had too bad of a winter here in Southern California. But there's something about those garden catalogs that just get us excited every time they come in the mail, and we look for everything that's new and exciting, and so hopefully we'll be able to share a couple of those things with you and tell you how you can find some out for yourself as well.
Exactly, and so of course today's topic for the show is hot veggies for the hot season, and that's because the first thing Kay is going to remind us is about seasonal planting in Southern California and what we have to do.
Well, every year, believe it or not, the seasons change in Southern California. We always laugh because unless you're outside every day, you really kind of don't notice it, except that the sun gets, you know, the nights get longer, the days get shorter in winter. And now we're changing that around to where at last, hallelujah, the days are getting longer and the nights are getting shorter. So for gardeners, that's a real yippy time because it means that we can start thinking about planting our warm season vegetables. We can start thinking about cleaning out those winter vegetables that might still be in our garden and look forward to the hot days of summer for some hot food. Yeah. From the garden.
And of course, everyone's favorite, I think, most everyone's favorite hot season veggie is tomatoes, because you just cannot get, unless you go to farmers markets, you just cannot get a decent tomato unless you grow it yourself. And even the ones you get in the farmers markets, while infinitely better than what you can usually find in the supermarket, it's still not the same as going out to your own backyard and picking that super ripe tomato off the vine and bringing it inside still warm from the sun.
I think we should have a national, like, bacon, lettuce, and tomato, or lettuce, tomato, and avocado day in Southern California, because there's a huge celebration in my house whenever the first big enough tomato comes in for that lettuce, tomato, and avocado or bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich, because it just sings on the plate.
Oh, that or bruschetta is my family's favorite thing. The first time I make bruschetta, everyone is hovering. They won't even sit down, and everyone's standing around the bruschetta bowl. So.
Yeah, bruschetta, yeah. And the easy appetizers they come with. Oh. You know, tomatoes just lend themselves to so many things.
Little mozzarella cheese, tomato and basil, and
caprese. There,
yeah,
you go.
Exactly.
Yeah, little good balsamic. Look it, we're already like...
Yes, we're slurping as we talk. So tell us about tomatoes, and you're so good about knowing about plant families and what their needs are and any problems that they could have. Tell us a little bit about that, and then get us excited about varieties we can try.
Well, you know, tomatoes are in the nightshade family, which put people off them years ago, only to find out that, wow, these are really delicious plants. They're actually in the same family with potatoes, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So some people are even developing something called the pom tom, which is part potato and part tomato. Don't try it.
I didn't know that.
Don't.
Pom tom.
Or tom tom or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they can blend these things together. But the plants have two varieties, a bush form and an indeterminate form. And that's important for the home gardener because the bush form grows to a certain size, blooms, and fruits all at once.
Right.
Sometimes that's a good idea, especially if you want to put some tomatoes up, if you want to dry some tomatoes, if you want to make some tomato sauce. be careful of that. Know what you're doing. And
but Romas, for example, would be an example.
Yeah. So then you have your indeterminate varieties, which you can think of as vining tomatoes, which grow and produce over time. So they will bloom, get pollinated, set fruit, grow some more, bloom, get pollinated, set fruit. And these are actually the plants that they use in greenhouses, where they'll actually trellis them up many, many feet tall. And they'll bloom and fruit in progression. So if you want a long harvest, look for on your tomato tags for an indeterminate plant.
Got it. And then tell our listeners a little bit about the difference between an heirloom tomato and a hybrid tomato plant.
Good question, Tina, because hybrid tomatoes have been developed to give you a very consistent plant, a plant of a consistent size, fruit. The plant itself is a consistent size if it's determinate. It also has a consistent set of characteristics for strength and vigor against diseases. So if you are a first-time tomato grower, look for something like an early girl, which is a hybrid, which is also disease-resistant. Extremely consistent tomato over time. The mother plant was strong. The father plant was strong. Don't think hybrid means that there's something wrong with the plant. You know, so many times we get a little afraid of things because of our political, what we hear. This has been going on for ages and ages, how we breed these tomatoes to be stronger for you in your garden. Delicious, disease resistant.
Right, and they've been bred through what you could call natural practices. They're not genetically modified.
Strong mom, strong dad. Yeah. Think of it that way.
Yeah.
Then you have your heirlooms, which are a plant that has been brought forward by farmers from year after year and has been grown for a consistent, generally a fruit size and flavor. This would be your Brandywines, your Paul Robesons, any number of, you know, ox hearts, and gosh, you start looking at those tomato catalogs and you're gone. There are so many different varieties, so many different flavors in those tomatoes. Boy, you get into those tomatoes and you get a lot of flavor. But it's important for the homeowner to know that you are not going to get the production out of these tomatoes that you would get out of something with a strong mother and a strong father, which is your hybrid.
Right. And also they have a reputation of being a little more disease prone. Is that correct?
They don't have the disease resistant. They didn't, you know, this is the same plant that's been brought forward sometimes for hundreds of years. So the roots are sometimes susceptible to various fungal diseases, as is the foliage. So you can have a pretty spectacular collapse if you get an early blight or a late blight in your tomatoes.
So the moral of the story, it sounds, is to ensure that you're going to have some tomatoes, plant some hybrids and some heirlooms.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always have my early girls in there because, number one,
I think
they're a terrific tasting tomato, consistent producer, and can just, you know, especially if you're here in Southern California, we get fogs at strange times of year. We get heat. We have a lot of variability in our yards. And those little tomatoes just take a lick and keep on ticking.
They do. I even had one over winter last year because we never, in 2014-15, we never got winter, you know, and so I had an early girl that actually produced for 2 years, and then I finally took it out this year,
but yeah. They're consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where would you suggest our listeners, because this is, as you said, such a plethora of choices out there, where would you suggest our listeners start to educate themselves if they don't know what heirlooms and hybrids they would like? How should they go about figuring that out?
Well, you know, it's a new world when it comes to tomatoes if you're just a beginner. And there's so many fun things to do. If you want to get a new flavor in your garden, take a little risk. Make sure you have your, you know, bread and butter tomato plant ready, you know. But then go and find yourself some kind of great new tomato that you've never tasted before. You know, they have pineapple flavors. Some of the black tomatoes have really rich flavors that are sweet and rich. So places you can go are, I think Rogers on March 4th to the 6th is having something called Tomato Mania.
Rogers Gardens, yep, in Newport Beach.
In Newport Beach, they're going to have 175 varieties. Go for a little adventure.
Yeah, I've been before, and they have so many tomato experts that if you pick up a tomato plant, you read the tag, and you are deciding between two or three, it's super easy to talk to one of their experts and see what they can give you in the way of information so that you can pick the one that makes the most sense.
It might make some sense even to look online before you go. Google tomato seeds, choices, so that you know what kind of tomatoes are out there. Do you want a small one? Do you want a large one? Do you want thick and meaty? Do you want a beefsteak?
Right.
And so that you can be directed to the right tables, because it's 175 varieties is a lot to winnow through. And be sure to go for flavor.
Yeah, go for flavor, and secondarily go for production if you don't have a lot of space. I know I'm usually limited to half a dozen, and so I always want to make sure that I have a couple of my tomato plants that I know are going to be reliable producers.
Yep, production is very important. Yeah, you don't want to grow a giant plant and only get five or six tomatoes, which can happen.
I did that with an heirloom 1 year, and it was a lovely tomato, but I was disappointed that I only got half
You'd
a dozen
fruit.
You've
given up a whole section of
spot.
Your garden for and it only gave you five or six tomatoes.
Right,
so
right.
Production is really important.
Yeah.
Another thing you can do on March 18th is that you can go to Veggiepalooza at Cal State Fullerton, or Fullerton Arboretum, Fullerton Arboretum, I believe, and they'll have a lot of new varieties in tomatoes and a lot of other vegetables too. That would be a fun day to go to as well.
And
go
what was
early.
The date of that?
That's March 18th.
March 18th. So as you can see from these March dates, if you hadn't already figured it out, March is the time to switch to these warm season veggies.
Well, it's time for your transplants. Now, if you want to get started from seeds, which can, you know, sometimes it's economical and sometimes it's not. With tomatoes, often you only want one plant.
Yeah.
So, you know, planting six of them is just going to give you a moral dilemma in your garden. Where are you going to put them all?
I know. I hate to be a plant murderer.
Exactly.
And so we should have planted those in January.
We should have gotten those started on heat mats. So the ones that you're going to be buying in March were started, you know, generally on heat mats and with, you know, high-powered lights. And so they're ready to go. They are wonderful because they give you a jump on the season.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I'm excited. I can't wait to get my tomatoes and get them in the ground. And, of course, there's always going to be that dilemma of which ones I'm going to try this year. So, but it's a fun dilemma to have.
It is. Yeah, but it's important. You know what happens is so many people squeeze their tomatoes in.
Yes. I've been guilty of that, but I have stopped.
I have too. I think when we, as beginners, we all put three tomatoes in the space for two.
Exactly.
And that did them a disservice because they really do need good airflow for pollination and resistance to disease, because airflow keeps the mildew from settling, all the fungal diseases from getting started. You really do need that airflow.
Absolutely. And while we're talking, while you've mentioned the fungal diseases, can you quickly just tell a couple of other issues that tomatoes may have that our listeners should be on the lookout for?
Well, in Southern California, the first thing is weather. And it sounds kind of funny, but you're not going to get production until the evenings are consistently warm.
And we forget that, because just because we don't get frost, we think we should be having tomatoes, but it doesn't work that way.
That's right. And they need to be in full sun. Mm-hmm. That's extremely important for tomatoes. They are just growing machines. They also need to, like I said, airflow. Mm-hmm. And the feeding of tomatoes is always, there are a lot of different prescribed ways to feed tomatoes. Go to our University of California Cooperative Extension IPM page and look under tomatoes, and you will get a full regimen for taking care of your tomatoes, which I highly recommend. It would take the whole program to go
through
the care and culture of tomatoes.
And so everyone knows that website is ipm.ucdavis.edu. It's the integrated pest management website that the University of California has. And let me tell you, it is the same thing as having an entire gardening library in your home. This is at your fingertips. You search by plants. So, for instance, if you were interested in tomatoes, you type in tomato, and it will take you to the tomato section where you can actually print out University of California publications on diseases, on insects, and on their control. So you basically have a whole tomato growing library at your fingertips by going to that website. And again, it's ipm.ucdavis.edu.
It's just a terrific site.
Yeah.
But one of the things I can really recommend to any gardeners is anytime they see yellow foliage on a tomato plant, just pull it off.
Yep.
Just pull it off. It's the cleanest, easiest, simplest, no chemicals required. Just get it off your plant, throw it away.
Kay, you did a talk out at the Great Park a couple of years ago and mentioned that. And ever since then, I clean my tomatoes or, you know, tidy them up. And I use a trellis system for, you know, tying them up, which gives them better airflow. And I'll tell you what, I have had so much less incidence of disease
right.
since I've done both the trellising and the removing the yellow foliage. It's just, I think that's one reason why I had some over winter, is they just stayed healthy.
They stayed healthy.
And yeah.
You know, there's so many great trellises out there. I know you and I are big fans of the Texas tomato cages, and you can make them out of concrete reinforcing wire. Mm-hmm. The little ones that you get from the hardware stores aren't generally too good. There's some better ones coming out there as well.
Oh, good.
But it's really important to get your tomatoes growing up. That's where they want to be, and to have that airflow go through the canopy of the plant for pollination and sanitation.
Just absolutely.
Getting the sun on those leaves is really important for keeping them healthy and growing them healthy. And that's what we like to do as master gardeners. We like those big, healthy tomatoes.
Yeah, because you don't want to have to pull your plant out early because it's sick and dying. You want it to last, these indeterminate varieties, to last the whole season.
Well, what we want is that production. We
exactly.
want more tomatoes. So, you know, just keep them clean and you will have a lot.
Yeah, good
so
advice.
So the variable weather conditions can be kind of funny on a tomato. You know, if you think about you standing out in the garden and having to, it's foggy in the morning, and then like this morning, an hour later, it's warm, and then this afternoon, you know, the wind could blow.
Right.
You know, so all of a sudden you go from very damp to very dry, and the plant is constantly adapting to that, as you would be. You know, you'd be putting on a hat, you'd be changing your clothes, and so some of those things take their toll on plants. So anything that you can do to keep the stresses down for them is good.
Right, and that does mean regular watering. So one thing that I've done in my raised beds where I use soaker hoses is I put them on a timer, because yes. if the poor things are relying on me to give them regular water.
And we're good gardeners.
And we're good gardeners,
but we're good gardeners.
We all get busy or, you know, go on a trip for a couple
life,
days.
You know, you need to go help somebody, and, you know, all of a sudden, it's always in August.
Or that's when vacations are, too.
So that little investment in a drip system is really good. And the soaker hoses are terrific because they water evenly across the surface of the soil in containers. Micro emitters are really good as well. It's important, though, to keep them moving around a little bit at a time in the pot, because they can actually set up a water column in the pot.
Good point,
So move them around and go ahead and hand water when you can to make sure that the entire contents of the pot are moist but not wet. Drainage is extremely important. If tomato roots get too wet, they have a tendency to rot. So make sure you have a really high-draining, high-quality potting soil in your pots.
Yes. And speaking of which, tomatoes are great container plants. There's no reason you can't grow tomatoes in containers.
You know, one year I'd had a section of bad soil, and I had to come out of the soil. I was doing a big tomato experiment with grafted tomatoes. And I had, I don't know, probably 20 15-gallon pails of tomatoes on my patio.
I remember
that.
It was
quite a jungle.
It was awesome.
It was pretty awesome. Yeah, those grafted tomatoes, I did have like 10-foot-tall tomato cages. But I used a really good potting soil, a professional potting mix that I got at Orange County, you know,
Farm Supply.
And, you know, they're a great resource as well in our community. And the tomatoes just grew like mad because they didn't have to reach too hard for food or water.
That's right. Can you tell, since you mentioned the grafted tomatoes, I was in awe of Kay the year she did all of these grafted tomatoes. Can you just give them a little brief description of how you graft a tomato and why you graft a tomato?
Okay, well, why you graft a tomato is because you're a little bit greedy like you and I. We want more of those absolutely awesome tasting heirloom tomatoes. And we have a small space. And maybe our soil, like I said, in one spot, the soil had had some problems with, you know, root knot nematodes. You know, I had some problems to overcome. I'd had some blight. You know, I just got tired of the hybrids not producing the way I wanted to see them produce. Mm-hmm. And so, and I'm not the only one. There are a lot of places where you can actually buy grafted tomatoes now.
Right.
So if you have had those same situations with, you know, problems in your garden where you haven't had the production or some kind of soil problem, you know, you might want to consider it. They are extremely expensive, and rightly so.
Right.
Because what you do is you have to grow twice as many tomatoes. You grow some tomatoes that are grown just for their roots. That's the root stock. And this is from a wild type tomato that is extremely strong and vigorous and just shrugs off any kind of soil problem. And that may not be forever, but, you know, it is very vigorous and strong. So it, even though it will have a problem, it will just keep growing no matter what. And then what you do is you splice the heirloom tomato on top of that rootstock. And it's a very precise.
Yes, you have to line up the stems of these two plants exactly right so that their tissue will come together. And yeah. I was amazed that she had all these little babies.
Clip them together, and you have to keep the conditions just perfect and humidity up. And it's very, it's extremely energy intensive. But I had got these tomatoes that were unbelievable because they grew like mad.
Yeah.
And the rootstock was so strong, it really helped the plants on top. There was a sharing of
strength. Yeah.
So yes, I would get 60 pounds of tomatoes.
So that's just so our listeners know that if you see a tomato plant at a nursery that is called a grafted tomato, and you're wondering why is this 4-inch tomato $10 when all the rest of them are $3 or $4, that's why. The effort that it has taken to create that grafted tomato is the reason that it's
right.
So much more expensive.
Right. It's a great kind of nursery specialty, and you know, you might want to try one for fun, but
yeah,
I don't know that I would do it again myself because
right.
It was quite energy intensive. Now that they're doing it for me.
Yeah, it's easier to buy one for $10 for a splurge.
Yeah, right. But,
okay, well, we obviously have spent a lot of time on tomatoes, yeah. But I think that's good because that is usually if people are going to grow one thing in a pot, they choose a tomato. So hopefully that has been helpful to the folks who are listening. But I do want to move on to our other hot favorites. And the next one I'd love to talk about, because I have to tell everyone that a few years ago, Kay opened my eyes to the world of peppers. I had for years grown my token jalapeno, so I would have some to put in salsa, and then I grew some bells for, you know, salads and stuffed bell peppers. And that was it. I was done. That was all I did with peppers. And then Kay gives this talk on peppers and opened my eyes to the world of peppers. So I'm hoping you can share with our listeners today all the different kinds of peppers and what they might want to do with them.
It was so much fun giving that talk because peppers have come out of the dark ages, and they are just streaking hot right now. It's important to know with peppers that, number one, just grow what you like, what you're really going to eat. And in order to know that, know your tolerance for heat.
Yes.
You need to understand the Scoville scale, which is a scale that tells you how hot the peppers are so that you're going to be eating. And they go everywhere from not hot at all, actually kind of sweet, to some of the uber hot military grade peppers.
Who knew there were military
yes.
grade peppers?
And these I really do not recommend them because they're actually kind of dangerous.
Sure.
They get so hot, you know, and if you don't handle them correctly, you can, you know, if you were to handle the pepper and then put your fingers in your eyes, you could cause yourself some serious damage. And so, you know, some of the Jalukas and the just, you know, they have they're called horrible names like Viper. And
so if it's a horrible name, don't plant it.
You know, maybe try one at the farmer's market. You know, sure. They're extremely expensive at the farmer's market. I don't think they're, you know, particularly hard to grow, but I wouldn't give the garden space up to them unless I was maybe going to figure out how to use them as some kind of pesticide or rabbit deterrent or something.
But turn them into a spray or
something. I grow peppers, I grow the peppers that I want to eat.
Sure.
So I happen to love chili relleno.
Uh-huh.
And so one year I went on the hunt trying to find the optimum ancho for my chili rellenos, because I wanted it to be a certain size that would kind of fill the plate and, you know, that I could get plenty of stuffings into. And as you said, seed catalogs are terrific for that, because I started looking for Italian peppers and peppers of all colors, golden peppers, red peppers, peppers that were the shapes of bull's horns, and peppers that were odd turban shapes, and peppers that were eensy weensy little peppers that you could just grind up and put a little in salad dressings.
Ooh.
So it's fun to just go on that adventure and look for different kinds of peppers. But don't get too high over your Scoville scale. Know what your personal Scoville scale is.
Sure.
So I can get up into the anchos, and I too will grow jalapenos. And there's a fun tapas pepper that is kind of a Spanish roulette that you can use for tapas, that you have to pick them when they're less than an inch in size, but then when they go from a certain size and a little bit bigger, they get extremely hot.
Interesting.
So it's kind of, they
have to be careful.
They have a little fun with those in Spain, I think.
Uh-huh.
They probably give the big ones to the gringos.
Why not?
They're making so many, and you get that big one. It's really fun. But you'll notice in the supermarkets that the big red bell peppers and the big yellow peppers and the big green peppers, they're beautiful. But trying to grow them at home takes a lot more water than most of us have.
Interesting.
So what's coming in now and what actually holds better in the refrigerator are the mini peppers.
Oh.
You've probably been seeing those. And those are far more approachable for the home garden grower. So, again, look in your catalogs, and if you're in catalogs, there are special peppers for pots and containers that are made to produce in small places.
Which I think is really important for our listeners, because everyone in Orange County generally has either a small or no yard, and so a lot of us are growing in pots, and if we're not, we're growing in small areas in our ground. So we have to be careful that we aren't choosing plants that are going to be too much for that space.
Right. And if you go into the smaller and medium-sized peppers, you'll get a higher production, which, oh my goodness, some of those beautiful Hungarian peppers, some of the beautiful, like I said, the anchos are my favorites.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when they all come in, it's hard to know what to do with them.
Yes. What do you do with them?
Well, if they're the smaller ones I want to dry, I just leave them on the plant to dry. But if they're medium to large, I will often roast. I will fire roast a huge batch of them at a time.
And how do you do that?
Well, I get, okay, so you want my secret?
Sure. Sure. Of course we want your secret.
So what I do is I get the barbecue. I heat the whole barbecue up super hot,
uh-huh.
You know, and make sure the grills are all cleaned.
Right.
And then I put my peppers flat across the whole surface of the grill.
Okay.
And I char them
uh-huh.
on both sides. This is the way you regularly do peppers. Then you take them off and you put them in a brown bag. You turn them over both sides.
Uh-huh.
And leave them in the brown paper bag for a few minutes. And when you go to take them out of the paper bag later, you can just slip the skins right off. They just peel right off.
Oh, interesting.
And what happens also is the pepper melts and softens in that process. It's had the hot, hot heat of the fire,
uh-huh.
which helps break it down a little bit. And then when you put it into the bag, magic happens. Be careful of the seeds, depending on, again, your Scoville scale of your peppers.
Sure.
And then clean your peppers. I often will have cored them and taken the seeds out ahead of time.
Okay, so you're roasting maybe half peppers.
Half pepper. And I still roast the whole pepper. You can just cut the top off and kind of pop the whole seed
out.
Part
Got
out.
It. Okay.
Yeah, and then you skin them and you can freeze them if you want for later, which is a great way to do it. They lose some of their flavor. The chipotle peppers, the New Mexico peppers, some of those are so terrific in chili later.
So you freeze them, take out a baggie of them when you're making chili or enchiladas or something.
Chop them up ahead of time if you want to.
Awesome.
And then you're ready for winter.
Yeah.
We should talk about heirloom beans sometime. But there are some terrific beans, too, if you really want to have a terrific chili. Grow some.
Well, I hope we're going to have time to get to beans, because that's another plant we should.
Talk faster.
Okay. Well, I have to take just a quick break and let everyone know that you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And a reminder that the opinions that we are expressing on this show do not reflect the opinions of KUCI or the Regents of the University of California. So, okay, I'm going to try some new peppers this year, but we do have some other summer veggies that I think we should talk about, because I do want everybody who's listening to know the breadth and the range of things that they can plant this time of year. So how about we jump into the whole squash family thing, because there's a whole lot of things to talk about there.
There is a lot to talk about there. You know, from the famed zucchini.
or infamous. If your neighbors run the other way.
Or you know how to paddle a zucchini that, you know, sometimes you find them at the end of the summer. They're just enormous. You know, don't let that turn you off of zucchini. Regular green zucchini are such a great thing to grow with children. My favorite, though, are golden zucchini. And you can't find them too often in any grocery store. They still are very productive. Not as productive as a regular zucchini, but the flavor is what is really worth going for. So if you want to start a couple of golden zucchini, by all means, go ahead and do that, because you're not going to find them in the regular store. Again, grow what's unique.
Sure.
If you can in your garden that you're not going to find. So zucchini, again, like squash, need full sun.
Mm-hmm.
They can be, they like to go into warm soil. They like regular water. And they take up a lot of room.
Yes, they do.
So one zucchini plant can easily take a 3-foot by 3-foot square. And, you know, it's tempting to want to squish two into the same amount of room. They are pollinated by bees and flies and all kinds of interesting things. So, again, sometimes people see a lot of flowers. Those are often the male flowers. You have to wait for the female flowers to be able to get fruit. So people will see a lot of flowers falling off of their squash plants and think that they're doing something wrong. Well, the plant is just waiting for things to get a little bit warmer to start putting out those female flowers.
That's a good point, because I've had a lot of people ask me, knowing I'm a master gardener, and they'll say, my squash plant has all these flowers, but I'm not getting any fruit. What am I doing wrong? And then I have to explain that to them. It's just not something that is generally known, I don't think.
Yeah, you can look down the stem, and at the base of the flower, there is not a little ovary, and you don't have any other plants with little teeny ovaries. Take those male flowers, take them in, put a little soft cheese in them, a little cream cheese, a little goat cheese, and you can pan fry them, and they are so yummy.
Oh, and you will totally impress guests if you
them.
Do that, because that is a super gourmet treat that not very many people do, because the flowers are hard to come by.
They're so, yes, very, they, yeah. Yes, and tender and delicious, a little simple breading on there and some sage in the butter in the pan.
Really good.
So
in case our listeners haven't guessed, Kay's an amazing cook. So you will love to eat vegetables if you go to her house and eat her vegetables.
And it's an important thing, because often we get to growing and things, I mean, I've become so charmed with lettuce sometimes, I have a hard time eating it because it's just so beautiful. And the same thing with eggplants. You know, I really have to throw them on the grill as well. That's my favorite way to eat. Eggplant is grilled. Don't get me started there. But anyway, we're back to squash. They take up a fair amount of room.
They do, but also know, especially if you have kids, that it is one of a child's favorite plants, because the fruit or vegetable part, whatever you want to call it, does mature quickly.
Yes.
And so the kids who have short attention spans can almost watch this happen.
Yes.
On a,
so grow that zucchini for your kids. But also know that when, as soon as they're tired of the zucchini and you can't look at it any longer, don't hesitate to just pull it out of the ground and plant something else there.
I'm so glad you said that. That just empowers people to get rid of something when you're sick of eating it. And it's not something we ever give ourselves permission to do.
We need to, because these are all edible foods. You go to the grocery store, you pay your $3 for a head of lettuce, right?
Right.
Okay, so here you have a 50-cent plant in the ground, and you'd really like to be having production or getting into something else, and yet it's still sitting there taking up all that ground at this 50-cent plant. But you have an emotional attachment for it. Somehow it becomes like the milk cow, and it's not. It's just a zucchini plant. So pull it out, and you know, it's your soil, gosh darn it all, or it's your pot. You know, it does kind of, they do tend to kind of take territory.
They do, they do.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel like it's the zucchini's garden after a while.
Well, now, we were going to talk about winter squash as well.
Yes, because a lot of folks don't understand the difference between summer and winter squash. I had some neighbors tell me last October when they were putting in their cool season veggie garden that they were going to plant winter squash because the name implied to them that they should plant it and have it there in the winter. And I had to tell them, no, don't plant those winter squash seeds. It's no time.
What they should really call it is something like long keeper squash.
There you go.
Because our forefathers and mothers, when they were planting their gardens, always put food by.
Right.
And so the food that kept through the winter was highly prized, and winter squash was one of those things. Now, not knowing how much territory squash needs to grow, the winter squash, I have innocently started on that project a number of times. And I didn't know how unproductive the vines were. And I happened to have sushi and had tasted kabocha squash.
Which is a winter squash.
Which is a winter squash. Mm-hmm. And it was delicious. Oh, my goodness. This squash was just terrific. So I ended up with a packet of kabocha seeds, and I put them in the ground. Well, this vine grew up the tomato trellis, 6 feet tall, was almost making it to the roof of the house, kept growing and growing. It never bloomed except for one bloom after about 2 months. And I came to find out later that kabocha only put off one or two fruits per plant. And
oh,
it would have taken over my whole garden. It would have taken over my roof. It would have. So just know, when it comes to your winter squash, you know, maybe that is a little better to let the farmers grow that one for you because they have the space and the room. But if you really want to have, you know, some shade capability, you might want to grow squash on the roof.
It'll shade your whole house, perhaps.
Now, sometimes there is problems with pollination with squash. So know that they need warm weather as well, full sun, and a good bee population. We need to be watching our bees.
Yes, absolutely. That's a problem for a lot of areas. But I find, at least in Irvine where I live, there are still enough wild bees that we seem to be doing okay with pollinators.
Well, it often helps to grow some kind of sustaining flower crop.
Which, of course, you know, in my garden, there's lots of
flower
crops.
So, you know, consider growing your herbs as well.
Absolutely.
Grow your basil in your vegetable garden for sure. Basil is a bee magnet.
Oh, I know. My kids were afraid of basil when they were little because there were so many bees.
So get those basil started early. If not to eat, then at least to attract the pollinators for your tomatoes, your cucumbers, your squash.
Great point. You know, I just do tomatoes and basils together all the time. But I have to remember that perhaps a lot of other folks aren't realizing what a pollinator plant basil is.
So it's a terrific pollinator plant.
The key to remember is plant that basil for the pollination alone.
Your sages are good too. There are a number of plants that you can grow that bring pollinators into your garden.
Yeah.
One that we used to plant a lot was, small, white, snowy on the ground, alyssum.
Alyssum, oh yeah.
Alyssum used to be a great plant for pulling beneficial
insects
into the garden, but it unfortunately it's also been shown to harbor some not so good insects.
Oh.
So stay with the basil.
Yeah.
And the lavenders and the sages. Those are good for hummingbirds, too.
And then you'll have all of these great herbs that you can incorporate into your
cookies.
Dishes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So what are some of the other squash family plants that we can plant this time of year?
Well, pumpkins, as you said, if you have children,
yeah,
you can grow pumpkins.
But just remind the kids that this is a long project. The reason we have pumpkins used at Halloween is that's when they're mature. So they take a long
time. All summer long. And again, like the kabocha, they're in that same family. They take up a lot of territory. So plant them someplace where, you know, if you head them towards the sidewalk, they'll grow all the way down the sidewalk.
You'll be tripping over them.
They really show kids the power of the sun in real life. Because the plants grow so quickly, often like a foot a day, that they really show how much energy is coming out of the sun and going into plant life. I think they're a vivid lesson in that.
Absolutely. And you can take, you know, like a little bamboo stick and have the kids put it at the end of the shoot one day and then go back, you know, a day or two
later.
and they can visually see how quickly that plant grew. And that's exciting for them to see.
It gets them, you know, there's so much of math and science to be found in the garden.
Oh, definitely.
That we really need to get back into the garden with our children.
Yeah.
And grandchildren. Neighbors and everything. So there are other squash, so the patty cakes and the crooknecks, and they take a little bit more food and water than the zucchini. You know, as I said, you can grow zucchini practically under the car, but again, good airflow for all of your vegetables, but especially for squash, because they have those giant umbrella-shaped leaves and are susceptible to the foggy mornings and the dry summers.
Right.
So, just know that.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I do like to grow, because I like to make homemade pickles, is I love to grow cucumbers.
Uh-huh.
I personally stick to the pickling cucumbers because you can let them get a little bit bigger and then use them as salad cucumbers. There's no reason you can't. But I do like to have them to make homemade pickles.
I do, too. One of my favorite things are called refrigerator pickles.
Oh, well, now how do you make those?
And they're so simple. You just scrub your pickles, your little cukes, and you put them in a hot brine and put them in the refrigerator for just a week or two. They're done really fast, and they last a relatively long period of time. You don't have to go through the whole
canning
process.
Thing. Oh, that's good for people to know who don't want to deal with the canning.
Who don't want to deal with the canning.
Yeah.
So there are recipes out there. You know, you can go to the ball.com site and find them. But the thing with cucumbers is they really do better growing up.
They do.
On a trellis and a strong trellis, you can use something like pig wire. It's between 2 4x4s. That's a great support for them. Easier to clean up in the at the end of the season as well. But the hard thing about cucumbers is finding them. Often you have to be a really good detective and look under the leaves to find them and get them when they're small enough. Always pick your cucumbers small.
Yes.
And check your varieties.
Yeah.
Make sure that they're sweet, burpless, et cetera. The Armenian ones, the Persian ones, there's some terrific new cucumbers out there.
Great, great things to try just for the fun of it. And I do like them also, as you said, you can trellis them. And so because I garden my edibles in raised beds, I'm always looking for space-saving techniques. And so I love the cucumbers because I can grow those on a trellis, and then right in front of them I can plant peppers or something else, and I still have, you know, I haven't used up a big chunk of my raised bed.
It really reduces their footprint in the garden. You can actually do the same thing with some of the longer vining squashes using pantyhoses.
Oh, yeah, to support the fruit.
Yeah. But it's, again, it's kind of a gardener hassle. You have to keep twining and vining the vines up, and if the vines collapse due to the weight, then there goes your fruit.
So, right.
I've done that as well, but sometimes the vine gets kinked.
Cuts off the circulation, just like with people. That's not a good thing. Okay, well, we have a little time left. Should we talk about beans?
Because I would love to talk about beans.
Because I know I got stuck early in my gardening career on, you know, the Kentucky Blue, and that was the only bean I ever planted, and I was completely oblivious to all of the other wonderful types of beans that are out there.
Well, you know, if you even got started as of, like, this moment, you could probably even get a short, sweet crop of peas in.
There you go.
Some of the smaller bush peas. And yeah. I love those, especially, again, if we're talking about children. Or for myself, I know they very rarely made it into the house because I would just walk by and eat them like candy.
The whole pod. Yeah.
The sugar peas.
Yeah.
And the snow peas and the... And they're pretty easy, again, if you have that simple, really simple but strong trellis, they're winners. But now beans really want it warm.
Yeah, and so the peas, you know, you can do it in March, but they're going to be done pretty soon. By June.
You're going to have that 30, 60 days things going on. Now then, when we're talking about beans and we're talking about eggplant and some of those really warm season plants, be thinking tank top weather.
Mm-hmm.
When it's hot enough that the soil is finally warm. I don't think our soil really got that cold this year. We didn't have any deep frosts. We didn't have any long... It was cold, but it wasn't down in the really cold, cold temperatures consistently.
Right.
I'm not sure what our chill hours are this year, but I wouldn't imagine they're too bad. But beans need to go into warm soil. And I often pre-sprout them just a little bit. I'll put them in a paper towel.
And you do those from seeds, not from transplants.
I do those from seeds, and I also use what's called an inoculant.
Explain what that is.
An inoculant is, if you remember your elementary school botany, they talked about some plants that were nitrogen fixers.
Right.
Which was the legume family, which are the peas and beans. Now, the peas and beans don't do it themselves. They can't fix the nitrogen themselves. They are in a symbiotic relationship with nitrogen-fixing bacteria that grow in little nodules on their roots.
Ah.
So if you are going into a sterile-type environment, which is something like, let's say you're using a sterile potting soil, or you're going into an area where, as many of our gardens have been, where the soil has been scalped and graded, uh-huh. for the housing to be built, there you won't have the nitrogen-fixing bacteria in your soil. So if you inoculate your soil, then when the plant puts its roots out, it has a ready source of that nitrogen-fixing bacteria, which helps it make its own nitrogen to help grow itself.
So do you put this inoculant in the soil itself?
You can actually put it in the soil. You can actually roll the bean seeds in it as a pre-plant as well. So it's right there when you're ready to go. A lot of people haven't had success with beans because of this reason.
Interesting.
So, again, Orange County Farm Supply online sources would have that for you. And it's not too expensive. You can get little teeny packets, and it really does help quite a lot for your beans. But some of the beans that are out there, a lot of times people do stick with the Kentucky Wonder or the Blue Lakes, you know, because that's kind of what we grew up with.
Right.
Branch out a little. There are so...
Sorry, Tina. I know. I have, finally.
There are so many better beans.
I agree.
And one of the ones I particularly love, because it's so productive in a very tiny space, and it's a very beautiful vine, it's a yard-long Chinese bean. Maybe it's a Vietnamese bean. Anyway, it's an Asian yard-long bean. And very sturdy plant, grows very tall, and is just an extremely consistent producer of beans that are about 2 feet long.
Oh, my gosh. Can you imagine kids seeing those beans? They would just go nuts.
And the beans, you know, we were always taught that when beans got big, they got woody.
Nasty,
and stringy, and, you know, they just...
Big seeds in the middle.
Big seeds, you know. These stay tender.
Wow.
Even when they grow that long. And they have a wonderful flavor. I even had a dog once that actually loved those beans so much. I had to wall in the whole garden because she would go out and find those beans and eat
that
them at every opportunity. It was really funny. They're delicious. Really delicious. Very lightly
steamed. Oh, I'm going to try those this year.
Totally different flavor. Better flavor, I thought, than green beans. But,
yeah.
You know, flavor is really subjective.
Yeah.
And as I said, the plant was a really beautiful plant and had very high production. You can also, if you're a really lazy gardener and have enough room, you can grow a lot of different beans for dried production.
Okay.
So, and that's a new thing coming up. The latest sunset just had a whole thing on all these different artisanal beans.
I haven't seen that yet.
So you might want to take a look at the artisanal beans that are out there. And if you have a little extra room and you can just water the plants and let them grow, come to full production, let the seed pods dry.
And then you shell them.
Shell them.
Yeah.
And then you have a dried bean, high in protein, that they are delicious. I know I got some from Gordo Bean Company, and I'm just sold on artisanal dried beans.
Wow, I haven't tried that yet.
Yep, you're going to have to try that.
Yeah.
That's a big thing coming. You know, there's a lot of artisanal out there these days. My son teases me because he's from the Bay Area.
Oh, yes.
Your daughter's from the Bay Area. So we've got to get the word artisanal in there.
That's right, because they're always on the cutting edge of all this stuff.
Cutting edge.
Well, cool. Well, just quickly, let's talk for just a second about eggplant. I know my family is not a fan of eggplant, but I have to tell everyone that Kay made me an eggplant aficionado because I went over to her home and she fixed eggplant barbecued sandwiches, like steak sandwiches. Oh my gosh, you would have thought you were eating a Philly steak sandwich. It tasted that good.
Okay, the real kicker on that one, I know you, it was a hard sell for you, I know. I'm not even sure I told you.
I don't think you did tell me what was in it.
Both my kids played water polo, and one time I had a team dinner, and I had a bumper crop and of eggplant. And I thought, darn it, I am just going to do this. Because, you know, teenagers.
Yeah.
I don't have to go there. So I peeled the eggplants. You don't always have to. But I thought if I'm going to get it past them, I'm going to have to, like, sneak this through. And a little extra virgin olive oil, a little garlic, a little kosher salt, mixed it up, and put it on the grill. Again, as I kind of, medium hot, in slices that are about the size of hamburger patties.
Yeah, yeah.
And also had grilled squash on the grill and grilled peppers on the, you know, all these grilled vegetables. Basically came back with like a whole bowl full of grilled vegetables and put them on like a fresh focaccia, which is an Italian
breadstick
bread.
Yeah.
And had this platter, giant platter, of these roasted vegetable sandwiches. And these teams of water polo players came in, and the entire platter, it was literally of like a foot tall, of these roasted vegetables, disappeared in like 5 minutes. And the guys went absolutely nuts for those sandwiches, as you did.
Oh, I did.
So if you think you don't like eggplant, you just haven't had it
cooked properly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's just so juicy and delicious, and it doesn't have any of that bite or that funny mouth feel.
Right. When you barbecue it that way.
When you grill it, it does a little something. I don't know if it drives some of that off, but yeah. You know, there's so many great kinds of eggplants, and they're so beautiful in containers.
Oh.
You know, the Japanese ones, that beautiful, the blossom is beautiful, the plant is beautiful, the fruit is beautiful. Make sure you stake them with a strong stake, because when they start putting those big fruits out off of that little plant, they start falling over.
They're actually great as decorative plants in your flower garden. I've put a few in my flower garden just because
they're gorgeous.
They're gorgeous. You get that purple or that lavender fruit
on
there.
Or they even have bright whites. There's something called ping. There's a number of ping tongue varieties as well that are a little bit smaller that have a little better flavor. You know, a lot of cultures revere eggplant. And so try a couple different kinds. You might want to even go to the farmer's market, grill some up.
Yeah.
Ask the varietal from your farmer's market fella and say, what is this?
Yeah.
So that you can look for it to grow it in your own garden.
Yeah.
They're very easy.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I'm a convert. Okay, we have about 5 minutes left, which I think is just enough time to tell folks what they need to do to plant all these veggies. So what do they do to get started with their soil and their location and all of that stuff?
Okay, well, I think I've already mentioned full sun.
Right.
I've already mentioned airflow, which is, for me, important for any plant. But let's talk a little bit about what it takes for a plant to grow, starting with the roots and the soil, because there's a lot of confusion about this. The roots have to be able to penetrate and get into the soil. So if you're going into our harder soils, make sure you break it up ahead of time. Get some organic matter in there. I even will often put a just a regular nitrogen fertilizer into the soil to give it a little help to get going, to get the microorganisms going in the soil, to loosen it up, soften it up. Water it well before you plant, maybe even a week before you plant, so that the moisture is consistent throughout your bed. This is a number one mistake a lot of beginners do, is they go buy the plant first, take it home, their soil isn't ready, it's hard, it's dry, and it takes soil a little while to get to the right consistency for soil. So it's a little bit like a crock pot. You have to get it started early.
That's a good analogy. Just like the crock pot.
So you can, you need to get started on that a little bit ahead of time. And make sure you have your supports ready too. Most of these summer vegetables are quick growers and the fruit is heavy. We've got a lot of sunshine going on those plants. They're going to be really productive, but they're not going to be productive if they fall over. So I know you and I have used rebar a lot of times. You can find it everywhere. It's much stronger.
It's cheap.
You can get it in different lengths. Mm-hmm. Have that on hand. Maybe even have it right there next to that eggplant. Maybe have three of them around these larger indeterminate tomatoes so that it's as soon as you plant that plant, you have the support ready for it. Because once the plant's fallen over, it's already undergone a lot of damage. Number three, always watch out after your plant gets started. Go out and just visit with it a little bit at a time. Flip those leaves up. Look for any kind of little beetles that might be munching on the leaves. Go to the IPM site to figure out what's going on and take care of it right away.
Early.
Because what happens with any of the hard-bodied insects is once they get kind of going and growing, it takes more chemicals to get rid of them if you wait.
Yes.
So, and we don't want to be using chemicals, so get in there early, know what's going on. Atmospheric things we can't do anything about. This is where we learn to be graceful people, because we have to, if you have a little powdery mildew, just know most of the times plants will grow out of that unless they're growing in the shade. So get your soil ready, get the moisture consistent. If you're using your transplants, make sure with tomatoes that you plant them deep. Remember, with tomatoes, you can plant them, what we say, up to their necks, where you can trim off most of the bottom foliage and plant it so that the stem will actually produce little rootlings coming
under
off
the ground.
Stem,
yeah.
Under the ground. So you can double your root mass, which is going to give you more production.
Yeah, that's a great thing to let folks know for tomatoes, because I think a lot of people think that they have to plant them at the same height that they are in the pot.
No, you
in
can
the pot.
Sink them into the ground. Make sure you get strong and sturdy plants, and don't overbuy.
Yes, I think that should be stenciled on my forehead. Well, Kate, we are just about out of time, and this has been so much fun. It always is, and I learn something new every time that we get together, and I'm sure our listeners did too, so thank you so much for coming.
Well, have fun with those catalogs. I see you have one.
I brought one, yes, because I have to go everywhere with a catalog. And the last thing I want to let our listeners know is you have been listening to In the Garden with UC Master Gardeners. Today, your master gardeners were Tina and Kay, and we want to let you know that if you would like to hear this show again or give someone else a link to it, we do have them as podcasts on our Master Gardener website, and that web address is uccemg.com. And there's also lots of other good stuff on that website and a link to our hotline where you can email us if you have any personal gardening questions that
Send
you'd like to get.
Yes,
attach a photo with your question. So thanks for listening. This is Tina and Kay.